On the show today, you could say we are doing some explaining. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Portland, Oregon, I'm Rima Khreis, in for Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, April 5th. Good to have you along. So we are on the explainer beat today to help us make sense of some of these headlines we're seeing, one of which has to do with the recent collapse of Silicon Valley Bank. We've been hearing of people taking hundreds of billions of dollars out of bank deposits and moving them into money market funds. And yeah, part of the reason for that is because of concerns over the stability of the banking sector. But another reason is just the good old-fashioned desire to make more money. Marketplace's Sabri Benishor explains.
A money market fund is a kind of mutual fund. But instead of investing your cash in like a bunch of different companies, it invests it in things that are much, much safer.
Short-term, very liquid, highly rated securities.
John Tobin is chief investment officer for Dreyfus. They offer money market funds. He's talking about short-term treasury bills, short-term municipal bonds, short-term commercial bonds, emphasis on short-term and low risk.
In order for a mutual fund to call itself a money market fund, one, it needs to be registered with the SEC, and then it also needs to operate under very strict rules or guidelines.
Rules limiting risk, rules making it easy to get your cash in and out fast. Now, over the last 3 weeks of March, money has been gushing into these funds. Steve Blitz is chief U.S. economist at T.S. Lombard.
Beginning with the week ending March 15th, money market mutual funds have taken in about $300 billion. It's about equal to the amount of deposits that have left the banking system.
Some investors were scared away from banks after two failed, but also money market funds make more money. Banks offer almost nothing on deposits. Money market funds now offer more than 4%. It wasn't always this way. Katie Nixon is chief investment officer for wealth management at Northern Trust. They also offer money market funds.
Prior to last year, when the Fed started raising interest rates, it didn't really matter where you had your money. You weren't earning any interest.
When the Fed started raising interest rates, the rates on all the stuff that money markets invest in, treasury bills, short-term debt, also went up. So the funds offered better returns. Banks, though, have a lot of long-term investments that are stuck at low rates. So they've been slow to catch up. Until they do, money goes where money grows. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishor for Marketplace.
So that was our first explainer. Now on to the second one. You may have seen headlines of an alleged financial fraud involving a startup and a big bank. Yesterday, the Department of Justice charged Charlie Javis with fraud. Javis was the founder of a financial planning startup called Frank. It is a company that J.P. Morgan bought for about $175 million back in 2021. According to prosecutors, Javis told J.P. Morgan her startup had more than 4 million users when it really had only 300,000. After scandals like Frank or what happened with cryptocurrency firm FTX, you've probably heard this question. Where was the due diligence? But maybe we should take a step back and start with a more basic question. What exactly is due diligence? Here's Marketplace's Matt Levin.
Maybe because it's kind of fun to say, due diligence has seeped into the vernacular. You know, like when you Google your latest match on Tinder.
Maybe you're going out on a date. And, you know, you want to make sure that this person is perhaps okay. And so you say, oh, yeah, I did my due diligence.
Ben Zimmer is the language columnist for The Wall Street Journal. He says the term really took off in the 20th century with corporate matchmaking.
Due diligence gets taken up to mean appraising a business. You have to figure out assets and liabilities and future commercial potential.
And with big corporate mergers and acquisitions, due diligence is a process where they bring in bankers and accountants and advisors and lawyers to look for anything that might jeopardize the deal. Kathy Wong is a law professor at the University of Virginia.
If you're buying a whole company, let's say that that company has a really important supply contract, and somewhere in that contract it says, hey, if you sell your company, we, the supplier, are not going to supply to you anymore.
Wong says the job of the due diligence team is kind of like the job of a home inspector.
You are trying to make sure that there's not any skeletons in the closet, the wiring is all good, like the amount that you're paying for the house is a fair price.
But for venture capitalists who invest in startups, you're not really buying a house, you're buying the idea of a house. David Schoenthal is an operating partner at Seven Wire Ventures.
we can do diligence on the developer that's building the property. We can say, all right, you haven't built this house, but have you built other houses?
In other words, a lot of venture capital due diligence is about the startup founder, background checks, references. And in a hot startup market, investors may feel they have to waive more thorough inspections just to make the deal. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today, it was mixed. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We talked on the show yesterday about jobs and how there are signs that the labor market might finally be cooling down. The headline from JOLTS, or the Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey, was that employers posted the fewest job openings in nearly 2 years. And today, a new data point from ADP shows us that hiring in the private sector slowed in March. Companies added 145,000 jobs, lower than what was expected. And of course, we'll get another view of the jobs picture on Friday with the March unemployment report. So what if you are someone looking for a job right now? Lindsay Ellis is a reporter with the Wall Street Journal, and she wrote about the class of 2023. Lindsay, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So you've been talking to soon-to-be college grads about their job prospects, about how they're feeling. What sorts of stories are you hearing?
Yeah, it's been a range. And I spoke with one student who has applied to between 50 and 100 jobs. She's at Texas A&M.
No way.
And she hasn't really gotten a lot of traction. I've also talked to other students who, you know, maybe have found success or have gotten some interviews, but it's not exactly in the field or the exact role that they had thought about when they initially started their job search. One thing that I've been hearing is that students are more willing to cast a wider net in response to some of the labor news and the jobs news that we've all been following over the last stretch. And so, well, I think, you know, to take a step back, there are jobs. It is a longer journey than many soon-to-be college grads would like.
Yeah. I mean, I'm hearing similar things. I actually have a brother who is graduating from college. He's a much younger brother who's graduating from college this year. He's scrambling to find a job. And it is just a strange time in the economy, right? Like just these last couple of days on this show, we've been reporting on how hot this labor market has been, but now we're seeing a bit of a cool down. It gives you whiplash, and it's complicated because it's not that hiring all across the board is waning, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was really well said. And, you know, yes, the unemployment rate is quite low, but the broader context here, many companies who typically hire these individuals have laid off many thousands of workers over the last few months. And that means that while there are still jobs out there, new grads are going to be competing not just with one another, but with many other early career folks who are suddenly out of a job. And so that dynamic, I think, is also making things a little bit more complicated.
We know that the first job of college can be pretty critical to starting your climb up the job ladder. What kind of long-term impact might we see from this?
It's a great question. You know, there has been some research about graduates who enter the workforce into a recession and that their earnings lag graduates who don't enter into a recession. But the U.S. is not technically in a recession right, right now. So I think that's sort of speculative at this point.
Yeah. And I want to briefly touch on student loans. The pause on repayment is almost over. How much of a factor do you think that that is for new grads as they're searching for jobs?
So when I talk to young professionals and students, you know, salary is definitely high on the list of areas that are really important to them. But many grads are really looking for a company that will offer stability. And yes, I mean, salary is key, especially for those who have you know, taken on debt and will need to start repaying those loans. But grads who I talk to are really hoping to land at a company that they will, you know, hopefully be shielded from layoffs or contractions.
Given what we know, I mean, obviously there's a lot we just don't know of what's to come. What would your advice be to new grads or soon to be grads?
I'm not really in the advice business, but I will say that, you know, the grads that I talk to, they are working really hard to get that first position. I mean, working just any possible connection to get a foot in the door, to get a conversation. And others, you know, we see all of these LinkedIn posts from folks who have been recently laid off and that those get traction. You know, some seem to be grads are doing the same thing, saying, hey, graduation is coming up. Here's where I am in the search. And one person who I talked to said that, such a viral post can lead to connections with alums or recruiters or otherwise. Yeah, exactly what you said. Hire me, please.
Lindsay Ellis is a reporter with The Wall Street Journal. Lindsay, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me and talking this through.
Okay, so I've got some moderately good news for those of you trying to buy a home right now. Moderately being the key word there. Mortgage rates have declined for 3 weeks in a row. Average rate on a 30-year fixed mortgage is down to 6.32% from a high of 7% in early November. That is still well above the 3% loans available in 2020 and 2021. Now, we've been doing a series on the show called Adventures in Housing, and for today's installment, a story of how one family's mortgage became two.
My name is Bonnie Ruff, and I live in a phenomenal Seattle neighborhood called Ballard, where I am a writer, a mom, I'm an urban farmer, and I'm the owner and host of Peach Street Farm, a family-friendly urban farmstay. In 2012, interest rates were really low, and we ended up purchasing our two-bedroom, one-bathroom, craftsman-style house in Ballard. The week we moved in, we had new neighbors move in right next door, another family with kids. I think about how many wonderful mornings. I just hear this dip, 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 the little footsteps coming up my porch steps, you know, to look for my daughters to come out and play. And they were just so involved in our lives. But at the same time, our neighbors are very connected with their relatives in the South. They are from Alabama and spent a lot of time going back there to spend time with their loved ones. So it was January 2021 when our wonderful neighbors came back from Alabama with the news that we dreaded for so long, that they were looking to move back to be closer to family. My first instinct was, I have to find somebody who already knows what my family is like to move in next door. And when that didn't work, I realized, wait a minute, sitting right here in front of me is this incredible opportunity for this lark of a dream that I've had for a long time to try to even out the uneven income that a writer makes by hosting families on a farm. We already have the cats and the big sheepdog and bunnies and quail. We could potentially still add goats or who knows what if we have two properties. Our very first guest in August 2021 had flown in late at night. And the next morning, I'm in the kitchen with my coffee and I hear the little footsteps coming up the porch. And I see a little, I don't know this kid, but he looks really nice. And this was 5-year-old Henry, who wanted to ask me, can I please see the bunnies? I thought, this is exactly what I was afraid I was going to miss. And here it is all over again.
Well, that was sweet. That was Bonnie Ruff with her sheepdog, cats, bunnies, and quail over in Seattle, Washington. If you've got a story about someone who helped you find a home, or maybe a home you found yourself, tell us about it over at marketplace.org. Coming up,
put the nuggets on the sandwich and you basically have a chicken burger.
I can hear my stomach rumbling. First, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones rose 80 points, 0.25% to close at 33,482. The Nasdaq gave 129 points, 1% to finish at 11,996. The S&P 500 slid 10 points, 0.25% to end at 4090. Cigna and United Health both gained after an upgrade from Raymond James. United Health picked up 1.6%. Cigna rallied 3.6%. I was talking with Lindsay Ellis about the job market for new grads. According to Pew researchers, 2/3 of respondents who asked for a higher starting salary than they were originally offered succeeded in getting more. Outcomes, though, unsurprisingly, were less favorable for women than for men. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.3%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Rima Khreis. A reminder for those of you all who've been meaning to do this but haven't had time, and we'll get around to it. The deadline to file your taxes is 2 weeks away on April 18th. That is, unless you live in one of a handful of states where the deadline has been extended because of severe weather. Now, if you are expecting a refund, expect that it'll be smaller this year. So far, according to the IRS, the average refund is about 10% less than what it was last year. That works out to about $400 per refund. Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
I don't know too many people who love tax season. Maybe just Mark Stieber.
It's a very exciting time.
It is his job. He's chief tax information officer at Jackson Hewitt Tax Service. This year, though, is maybe a little less exciting.
This year's been quite an anomalous year for many taxpayers.
Because many filers are getting smaller refunds than they did last year, and smaller than they expected. That's not a surprise to Stieber or anyone in the tax world, but it has been for a lot of people filing.
Most taxpayers are pretty short-memoried. They think this year's tax return will look a lot like last year's, and that's the bar. So when it doesn't, they get very concerned and very surprised.
There's one main reason refunds are notably smaller this year.
Largely because temporary pandemic relief has dropped out of the tax code.
Erica York at the Tax Foundation says last year, a lot of people got extra money in their refunds from the child tax credit and the earned income tax credit. Both of those were expanded temporarily to help people through the pandemic. Some taxpayers also got stimulus payments they'd previously missed out on. This year, there's none of that.
It's a pretty big change, especially for lower income families.
The expansion of the child tax credit alone increased the income of the poorest families by about 10%, she says. And for many low and middle income families,
their tax refund is the largest single payment they receive all year, and it can represent a pretty big share of their total annual income.
So when the size of that refund changes, especially unexpectedly, York says it can have a big effect on people's budgets. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
If you are someone who spends a lot of time on TikTok, then you might be familiar with our next story. It is about a corner on this app devoted to restaurant and fast food hacks. What is that, you ask? Well, it can be a lot of things. Sometimes they are viral videos of people sharing a fun play on menu items, like, hey, go to Waffle House and ask for bacon melt with waffles instead of bread. Or maybe they're inflation-related hacks, like, here's how you can save money if you go to this restaurant. Whatever they might be, these videos, from the restaurant perspective, can either be wonderful for business or an absolute pain. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has that story.
Susie Vinette recently worked at a Starbucks in Austin, Texas, and she noticed this pattern. In the morning, she'd get her regulars, ordering a drip coffee or a latte. But in the afternoon, after school let out, the kids would descend on the store. And the orders, they'd get complicated.
They are picked up by their mom and they're in the backseat of the car and they're, you know, reading off the instructions to their mom at the drive-thru. Or they come into the lobby and they order these bananas drinks and they look at me like I'm this geriatric weirdo that like, I'm like, can you say it again? Wait, go back.
She says a lot of young customers, they would order drinks like the Mermaid Frappuccino, the Medicine Ball, Taylor Swift's drink. Every order would end with a selfie because these drinks, they start on TikTok. Right now, the Barbie drink is all the rage. And if you're on TikTok, you know how these videos go. People lay text over the video and set it to a song. And the song of choice? The Barbie drink is, deep breath, a venti vanilla cream frappuccino with 3 pumps of vanilla, 3 pumps of raspberry, half and half, mixed with freeze-dried dragon fruit, topped with whipped cream, and more dragon fruit. It is incredibly pink.
In the end, these people are coming out with like $8 drinks that like started at like $4 and they just customize wildly.
Menu hacks have always been a feature of fast food. A double-double animal style with well-done fries, anyone? But Alex Suskin, who directs the Food and Beverage Institute at Cornell, says the combination of social media and digital ordering has made it easier for people to Frankenstein together new foods. Even he has a go-to hack at McDonald's.
You order a double quarter pounder and a 4-piece McNugget, and you basically put the nuggets on the sandwich, and you basically have a chicken burger.
Suskin says these word-of-mouth trends, some of them are combinations customers have discovered. Others are actually created and planted by the companies themselves to create hype.
Restaurant companies have always been aware of the value of being on the inside, right? Creating something where you know something that other people don't know, and that creates a sense of, uniqueness. It creates an added value.
Added value, yes, and sometimes chaos. Tressie Lieberman is VP of Digital Marketing at Chipotle.
People are always trying to hack the menu. And when there's a lot of different items on the side, it can actually slow down the line.
Not all hacks are about fun and excess. Some are hacks to save money. Take the $3 burrito hack at Chipotle. It involved ordering a single taco, ordering tons of free and cheap sides, and assembling the burrito yourself. Chipotle banned the order because, well, $3 burrito. And also because fast food margins are all about speed, the predictable assembly line. Anything unusual slows it down. But hacks are also a great form of marketing and menu development. Take last summer when content creator Alexis Frost ordered a steak quesadilla with fajita veggies and a side of queso.
Tastes just like a Philly cheesesteak. 10. Uh-huh.
Other creators picked up the trend, and Frost says, before you know it,
I mean, it just really broke Chipotle.
It became so popular that Chipotle added it to the online menu. It's even labeled as seen on TikTok. Since then, Chipotle has seen digital sales hit their all-time high. Most of those customers also signed up for digital rewards. And for Chipotle, digital rewards means data. Frost got something out of it, too, a business partnership. The former high school math teacher says she makes anywhere from $5,000 to $35,000 from these types of deals. Still, most of her content is on her own, hacking menus from the front seat of her car, with care.
I can understand how that could probably be really frustrating to someone that's working and like trying to do all these things, right?
She says she usually orders most of the items separate and assembles them herself. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
By the way, I too am guilty of falling for viral menu hacks. Tall iced chai with oat milk, pump of vanilla, sweet cream foam, and caramel drizzle may or may not be my go-to Starbucks order. Anyway, this final note on the way out today, saw this headline about Chipotle in the Wall Street Journal. Apparently, people on the internet, on Reddit, TikTok, are up in arms over the inconsistency of Chipotle's tomatillo red chili salsa. Is it getting hotter, they ask? Am I just becoming weaker? To find the answers, the Wall Street Journal sent samples of the salsa to a lab and confirmed that, in fact, breaking news, not every pepper has the same spice level. In response to the uproar, the company now explicitly labels its options for milder sauces so they can once and for all squash the heated debates. All right, before we go, your moment of economic context. If you are traveling during this long Easter weekend, there is some new data out from Airports Council International. It shows that last year, Atlanta's international airport was the world's busiest, followed by airports in Dallas, Denver, and Chicago. Atlanta's airport transported nearly 94 million passengers, which actually was still 15% lower than before the pandemic. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. And I'm Rima Jerez. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.